With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going, you're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the publisher fight. It's time for the publisher fight.
Here's a man that really appreciates that new England pound.
Hi, how's it going? And welcome to the Video Week podcast. My name is Vincent Flood. I'm the editor-in-chief at Video Week. And in this episode, I'm speaking to Matt Sattel. Matt's the chief revenue officer at OpenX, very much a very long-established and highly regarded programmatic ad platform. It's a very interesting conversation. Matt was extremely candid, and we talk about in-housing, which is something Matt has plenty of experience in from his days at MIQ. We also talk about what made Matt want to join an SSP. We talk about OpenX's positioning in the market, by which I mean, have they picked a side between buyers or sellers? We also talk about why OpenX don't deal with resellers for CTV and the practice of reselling generally. We get into curation, whether honesty pays in our industry, and whether our industry KPIs are fit for purpose. So plenty of meaty topics there. Now, it wouldn't be a Video Week podcast if I didn't present you with some opportunities to attend our events. We've got New Video Frontiers, our flagship conference, coming up in March. That's March 5th and 6th in London. And we'll have over 1,000 attendees over 2 days. So if you're a brand, an agency, a media owner, or a technology company in this space, it's a must-attend event. Very CTV heavy this year, I will say, but we will be getting into multiple topics, and you can check out the agenda on newvideofrontiers.com. Then if you're an industry leader in the video advertising space, and you should be coming out to Video Rise, which is a more intimate leadership event, which will be taking place in Prague from the 13th to the 15th of May. We limit it to about 50 people, so it's normally a senior crowd. The idea is that, you know, we provide a space for people to have interesting conversations and to hopefully push the industry forward. And by limiting the numbers, it sort of helps us in that task. It's a fantastic event. The Rise events are my personal favorites of all our events, and often they are reportedly the most impactful for attendees too. So you should be involved in that one if you're a senior leader in the space. Now, I'll cross over to my conversation with Matt, and I hope you enjoy. So, Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We usually kick things off by delving into a person's past. And I'm curious, yeah, how did you start out your career, and how did you come to be the CRO of OpenX?
Yeah, so I went to just standard business school and ended up getting an internship, which sounds like crazy to be talking that far back. But I got an internship for working for Visit Florida and a bunch of other like CBB, like consumer business bureaus. And it was a interesting thing because I actually got into paid search. So I started out my career going on the agency side, focused on paid search long before kind of the biddable programmatic media space happened. And my evolution kind of went from paid search to programmatic as programmatic evolved, as I moved over to the holding company side where I was at Spark, under the Publicis umbrella. And so the first, 10 years of my career was heavily focused on agency, paid search, getting into the programmatic space. And then I went to the sales side, and worked at a variety of different data companies. And then prior to coming over to OpenX, I actually went to a company called MIQ, and I think a lot of people know MIQ for their more standard, like managed service programmatic capabilities. But I actually oversaw and ran our global in-housing consultancy. So we were actually working directly with large brands who were looking to in-house their programmatic advertising. And that's actually how I got introduced to OpenX through a lot of the work that I was doing on at MIQ. Came over to OpenX, and then, that's kind of what led me to the role of CRO at OpenX. Happy to get deeper into any of those because I'm
with a variety of
experiences.
I'm a big fan of MIQ, and I think, you know, in the early days of programmatic, when, you know, there was this whole host of new capabilities that programmatic enabled, but there was very few people actually doing it. And I know MIQ were one of the companies actually doing the hard work, the sort of smart stuff and getting the best out of data. I'm curious about on the in-housing side of things. You hear very mixed results about in-housing. I've sort of accepted that there's no conclusive correct answer to this, but you know, you do hear companies who, you know, they'll say we've brought stuff in-house, we'll never go back. You've said some that where they want, they've got that sort of hybrid in-house but still working with an agency model, and then you've got many who, you know, maybe have tried in-housing but they actually just realized it's very hard to get a sophisticated programmatic buyer to work in. You know, it might be a less glamorous town in some instances, for example, or maybe people get bored working on the same thing. And I say that with the greatest respect, there's a lot of great in-house teams who absolutely love what they do and do really cool stuff. And they've got an amazing team who are very happy. So what was your experience of working directly with advertisers?
Yeah, I think everything you said is true. I think that what we talked about when I was at MIQ and running that team was the hybrid approach, that there are certainly things that agencies can do better because based off of buying power, things like that. I think for what we talked a lot about and what I actually still firmly believe in is brands taking control of contracts and taking control of the transparency behind what they're buying and how they're buying it. So for me, I don't think that there's a requirement for in-housing to mean that you own the contracts, you do all of the trading, you're buying your own linear TV. I think the hybrid approach is what we typically recommended. And in some situations, that hybrid approach included MIQ as the buying arm and continued to be the buying arm. In some situations, it was working with the agency to make sure that that what was happening was exactly what the buyer should be buying. And I think you talked about it a little bit before that MIQ really did do what they said they did. And they were really advanced in how they were trading, how they were looking at their relationships with their tech partners. And they were very advanced in even things within SPO, doing really deep analysis within S-Chain. And I don't think even a lot of the largest holding companies are doing that level of analysis when making SPO decisions. So I think MIQ's approach was, and I think remains to be true, is you can take it all in-house. That's challenging. You can do a hybrid approach with MIQ, or you could do a hybrid approach with MIQ and the agency, or the agency of record that has historically been doing the buying. And sometimes that looked like some programmatic remained in-house while, you know, linear buying was happening within the agency. It kind of was all over the place, and depending on the goals, often laddering up to the CMO. But I think what you had commented on is, I think there was a couple pitfalls. So a lot of brands are headquartered in areas that that there's not a lot of programmatic talent. So I think hiring talent is challenging. I think with kind of this remote first world, I think that has made it a little bit easier. But, you know, I've even seen some in-housing teams that did hire remote that are trying to get people back in office now. So I think it is challenging. And I think a lot of people think they're going to save a lot of money by in-housing. And I think what they end up finding is that it's a lot more challenging. And I think often do revert back to the agency model and maybe with a new appreciation of what it is to work with an agency.
There's something in the just being exposed to multiple clients as well.
Yeah, it's funny. My brother worked at a holding company for a long time and did a quick stop at a brand. And one of the things he commented on was how much he missed being able to work on multiple clients, get experience of like different KPIs and how to trade differently based off of different KPIs. And so I think there's something very true about that, that working on one particular brand or client can be really challenging, even in your understanding of what else is out there from data, tech, anything like that.
And I think you learn from the clients as well. So it's this client does things that way or whatever else as well. There's a symbiotic relationship, and I think you learn transferable skills, which if your agency is doing a good job of managing conflicts in its portfolio, shouldn't really be a problem to bring over to another client if it's not a competitive situation. From there, what made you jump over to want to work with an SSP?
When I was at MIQ, when I first started the in-housing function, most of what we talked about was what is the right number of DSPs to work with? Are you working with the right DSPs? That was the conversation, and it quickly evolved over a couple of years to more of the SPO conversation, where if you're working with the right number of SSPs, and you're working with differentiated SSPs, there's a lot more value that you can get out of your working media dollars. So we evolved our story quite a bit in how we position ourselves as more of kind of the experts on SPO and making sure that you're working with the right number of SSPs versus making the recommendations on DSPs. And we talked about this before. I firmly believe that MIQ is typically a little bit ahead of the curve in terms of how they're trading. So the fact that we were doing that, I felt pretty strongly that the rest of the industry was going to catch up to that as well. And when I was doing a lot of that SPO analysis and working with a really smart team at MIQ who actually did the analysis, OpenX always really was kind of a leader in their directness. They were building and creating tools for buyers that I thought were really interesting. And they had really leaned into the data and identity story that's continued to be a driver of success for OpenX. And that was really interesting to me. So when the opportunity presented itself, it seemed like a no-brainer because I really did believe in the evolution of SSPs and how SPO is going to be a huge driver of more working media dollars and probably more importantly, a focus on privacy and transparency.
So wait, you touched on a few things that make me want to ask the question that, you know, how does OpenX position itself today? And I'm thinking particularly when it comes to, you know, does the company align itself, do you align yourselves specifically with the buy side or with the sell side, or are you agnostic on sides and more of a transaction layer of sorts?
Yeah, I think it's a hybrid. I think I joke with a lot of my friends in the industry and not in the industry that working at an SSP should be just a straight up case study in supply and demand within in business school. Because constantly when we're launching a new market or new country, we talk about the fact that it's really challenging to get the demand if you don't have the supply, but it's also very challenging to get the supply if you don't have the demand coming through. It's the first question a buyer is always going to ask you, like, can I see the list of publishers you're working with in our region? And then when you talk to the publisher, they're going to ask, how much incremental demand are you going to drive to me? So I don't think that there's any sort of a focus on one or the other. I would say when we're thinking about tools and capabilities and our product roadmap, it is often centered around buyers' needs. And there's a couple of reasons behind that. I think ultimately the more demand and the more incremental demand that we can drive to publishers, the happier the publishers tend to be. And I think that buyers are often pretty demanding with what their expectations are and how you actually drive differentiation for buyers within the SSP space. That's a big topic in market is how are you differentiated as an SSP? And I think for us, it's focusing on a product roadmap and capabilities that drive value to the buyer is how we've really focused our identity in market. And I would also say, just to get like a level deeper, data and identity has been core to OpenX since 2017 when we built an identity graph and really started the curation story and focusing our capabilities around curation. And I think curation has taken a massive evolution, which I would imagine we're going to get into more deep later. But I think data and identity, being the first and only SSP with an in-house identity graph and identity spine, for both the open web and CTV, I think is really what we've leaned into.
You know, I know big focus for you guys, and we're going to return to the curation chat. But you know, big focus for you guys has been in the CTV side is that you don't deal with resellers. And I'm just curious, just how common is reselling in the CTV space? You know, there isn't a huge amount of open market trading in CTV in Europe. It does happen, but it's by no means the preferred option. And yeah, I'm curious about how resellers are managing to carve out market share, you know, whether it's in the US or anywhere else.
Yeah, I would actually say it's probably more prevalent than people realize. There's a lot of, seller hopping that's happening in CTV, even within deals. So we've done a lot of work within CTV from a product and capability standpoint. And to your point, one of the main things that we did early on was we eliminated any sort of reselling from our supply, which I think is valuable. But it's probably also important not to pivot the conversation, but to talk about why we did this. And kind of the feedback that we were hearing from buyers. So if you don't mind, I'll kind of comment on that, and which will take me back to your original question.
All good,
But
all good.
great. Yeah, so you're talking about the TV by OpenX product that was launched a little over a year ago in the US, and then in June, this past June, within the European markets. So one of the things that we did was eliminating any sort of indirect supply from the exchange. But some of the other work that we did, which I think is equally as important, was we recategorized things that weren't true glass on screen. So within a CTV buy, you might end up getting a lot of OTT or mobile, things like that. So we went through a big initiative to recategorize everything. So if someone is buying CTV through OpenX, they know that what they're getting is the true glass on screen, the large screen experience. And then we also eliminated anything that we didn't think was what buyers would ultimately want to align around. So think of like fireplace apps, things like that. We eliminated from the exchange, and that's what is packaged as TV by OpenX. And the reason that we did it was direct feedback from buyers that they're buying through almost exclusively through PG, PMP buys because there's not a lot of trust in CTV. There's a lot of supply that they don't really want to buy, and there's concerns around paying CTV premiums for mobile actual experience. And then in addition, there was a desire to buy in more biddable programmatic ways, and to do things like audience buying and being able to utilize their own first party data, do more advanced targeting solutions that would allow for CTV to go kind of down the purchasing funnel. But the challenge with that is without the trust and transparency in what someone's buying within CTV, it was really challenging to scale out those strategies. So for us, by doing the things that we heard directly from buyers was important to allow them to start buying in a more programmatic biddable way. And we've seen a massive influx of spend coming through our CTV pipes directly after that TV by OpenX initiative launched. And it's also really positive for publishers too. After TV by OpenX launch, we actually saw an average of 22% increase in monetized impressions for our publishers. And that's directly tied to the fact that these campaigns are incremental. We're getting CTV on plans that typically CTV wasn't going to be included on because they couldn't do kind of the targeting solutions that they're used to in the other programmatic channels.
And I'm curious about you know, just jumping back to what I was asking you about, you know, which side you align yourself in with. I'm curious what you make of, you know, we've got the Trade Desk, for example, with OpenPath, but still claiming, oh no, we're fixated on the advertisers. It's just a direct connection into supply. Similarly, yeah, Index maintain that they're, you know, firmly wedded to publishers and feel, you know, Andrew Casale made a very strong case on the podcast for, saying that, their focus was on publishers, and DSPs could never replicate what all the work that goes into managing publishers' supply, the different formats, delivering for them and their interests. And he felt that there is a you can't possibly resolve the conflict, by working on both sides. What's your view on that?
Yeah, I tend to believe that there is a space for both DSPs and SSPs in the ecosystem. I think it's why we evolved past the ad network days, which I don't think anyone necessarily wants to move back towards. But I would say there's, a time and place to buy direct, and then there is a good portion of programmatic strategy that I firmly believe requires both a DSP and an SSP. I think people forget often that SSPs are also at the center of kind of supporting publishers in how they get paid and making sure that they're paid fairly. So I'd say that there's that's kind of a missing part of what most people kind of talk about when thinking about DSPs and SSPs, that SSPs have been working with these publishers for a long time and provide a lot of value back to the publishers. I think where I believe things are evolving is there's probably capabilities that have lived within DSPs might start to evolve and fit within the SSP's capabilities. And I think in some situations that could happen vice versa. But I do believe that there is going to be like a focus on that kind of direct PG buys. If you're doing a buy with a single publisher, that could evolve to being just within a DSP or just within an SSP. But I think that for a majority of programmatic buys that do require or will require DSPs and SSPs working together. That's my stance, is I think that there's a place for both. I think it's actually the capabilities that live within each that might start to evolve over the next couple of years. And transparently already have evolved. Like you see that with the curation topic that you can't escape on LinkedIn right now.
Yes, let's get into that because yeah, it seems to be a debate that I'm not sure if it is still trundling on, but I don't think it's far from resolved. And yeah, I mean, okay, maybe just for the benefit of anyone who doesn't know, because it's never nice to just assume people understand what has been going on in this debate around curation.
God, that's a really difficult thing to answer because it depends on which article you read, or who you're
True.
talking to. But
Well, some
I
people are saying
think
it's an ad network. I think some people are saying, first of all, let's explain what, if you could explain what curation is, and then maybe we can move on to, yeah.
So it's actually funny. I think what curation is, in my opinion, is actually probably the debate often. And you can read, like I've read multiple articles where they're interviewing three, four people, sometimes me included, and every single person is talking about curation in a different way, which is why I think often there's a lot of confusion around what curation is. So what I can do is kind of share what I believe curation is, and how I think it's evolving. And I think it's actually the evolution of curation that people are kind of debating, or where there's that healthy debate going on. So curation has existed for a very long time, right? And I think it looked a lot like what auction packages have been for, many, many years within programmatic. So it's the ability for SSPs to create customized lists of publishers that are going to drive either the contextual relevance, the performance, or ultimately like the value back to the buyer, within kind of a single deal ID. So, that's been around for a very long time, and I think it's been something that has been very prevalent. I don't know many agencies that don't buy in that way. And in fact, I would say if you talk to some of the largest holding companies and a lot of the smartest brands, they're moving away from the open exchange and trying to move as much of their programmatic spend into deal IDs, which again is curation. I think what is been evolving over the years is data-driven curation. So you have like these curation houses that are selling kind of curation as a service, which I think that's where a lot of the debate comes in around. I think some people are like, should agencies be pushing, high percentage of media fees to these curation houses, or should the agencies be doing it themselves, or should they be working with their SSP partners? So I think the debate is a little bit around like where curation should live. And the definition of what curation is, more so than like, is curation real or should curation be happening? It already has been happening for a long time. I think the debate is more around data-driven curation.
Yeah, I've had some people. Is it an ad network? Is sometimes is a regular question, and not that that's not necessarily people like Anthony Katzer from IAB Tech Lab, who I would regard as an authority in many respects. But then you know people vehemently disagree and say there's no way this is comparable to an ad network. Then you have other people who seem to be. using curation in an ad network like way. So I think like you say, it's often comes down to the eye of the beholder.
Yeah. I mean, I also, like I said, I think curation has been this, the versions of curation have been happening for a very long time. And nobody was really commenting on it. Like it was an ad network. I do think, you know, the data driven curation piece is interesting to a lot of people and it's starting to get quite a bit of usage. But it, you know, it has been for a long time. We have had a very large percentage of our business, which in essence has been curation since 2017, when we built our identity graph in this platform called Open Audience, which is something that many data providers that many agencies are utilizing actually use to push out a combination of their data and our audience, or sorry, their data and our supply to DSPs. That's not much different than what people are buying through SSPs now, which would be considered data-driven curation. I would say the interesting thing is this was kind of just called supply-side targeting before. And I think the industry has just kind of shifted supply-side targeting to being called curation, or at least in my opinion, that's what's happening. But I don't think that there was a huge amount of pushback on supply-side targeting in the same way that the coined curation term is getting.
One thing I frequently hear is that, you know, people often view a lot of the SSPs. I mean, there's only so many ways to skin a cat and we're just trying to sort of sell inventory. And, you know, some people will say that, you know, the various SSPs aren't particularly distinguishable from one another. I mean, how do you differentiate yourselves from other platforms?
Yeah. I would actually say people who have that opinion probably are a lot less close to the SSPs than people who have the opposite opinion. I firmly believe that. I believe that when I, prior to being at an SSP, and I believe that actually even more now. So I think that there's a lot of ways that SSPs ultimately differentiate. I would say some of the biggest ways, I think it's interesting. I talked a little bit about back in the day when I would work on S-chain analysis at MIQ. And I think the average campaign prior to having any sort of SPO was running on like something like 72 different SSPs. So I think that there's a combination of how do you differentiate from the, you know, many, many, many SSPs that in some situations people don't even realize are an SSP. And then how kind of the largest of the SSPs differentiate. So I think that the first step of it is, do you have what percentage of the kind of like premium supply do you have access to? And, you know, Jounce does a great job of putting out their bellwether report, which ultimately shows which SSPs have the most direct supply broken out by channel. So I'd say like, that's the first thing. That's not necessarily how the biggest SSPs differentiate from each other. Because for the most part, the percentage differences in direct supply within the big SSPs are pretty minimal. But I would say that kind of, if you're looking at an SPO from an SPO standpoint, that's what differentiates kind of the largest SSPs from some of the longer tail SSPs out there. I would say one of the other things that's started to differentiate SSPs as buyers have more reliance on working with SSPs is global presence. So it's not just, do you have global supply? It's also, do you have people in our key markets? SSPs were considered dumb pipes years ago. Not many of the SSPs have put people in key regions to allow the local markets to be supported directly by somebody in that market. So I think a global expansion initiative is also a huge differentiator. It's not like the fun, sexy thing to talk about, but I think if you talk to a buyer and there is an SPO checklist, that global presence is something that's really high up on that checklist. Almost as high as probably your directness. Because I think, you know, if you're a large brand and you're going through an SPO exercise, there's a common knowledge that if there's supply gaps in a particular region and your supply is all consolidated to a certain number of SSPs, publishers will likely integrate to get access to that demand. So those two things are interesting. But then I think people have done a great job of differentiating themselves. I think, you know, Magnite has done an amazing job historically of being a leader in CTV, specifically around like their acquisitions and what they've been focused on. Our differentiator has really always been our data and identity narrative. So, and it's not just a narrative, it's the products that we've built. So again, I commented on it before. We own our own identity graph. It's used by data providers out there. It's also used by agencies for to access their own first party data, the data arms of their organizations. It's, you know, a lot of those holding companies have called it kind of the easy button, where they've connected their data in directly through our identity graph to our supply. And it's something that their trading teams are easily able to just start activating. So I think that data and identity has really been our core differentiator. But I, you know, there's smaller things too. Like I think we didn't talk a ton about this with Curation or TV by OpenX, but we've worked with our publishers to standardize things like genre and in general content signals within the CTV space. We have access to a massive amount of that data. We actually turned, I believe it was about 11 million different genres into 120 standardized genres, which is equal to a huge influx of higher CPMs and also higher monetized impressions for publishers, because we've seen that DSPs bid more when there's a content signal included, and buyers are willing to pay more if there's a content signal included. So the work that we've done on that, because again, we're seeing all of that without any sort of QPS constraints like the DSPs would have, that to me is driving massive differentiator and differentiation in the CTV space.
Yes. I've spoken to many quite sophisticated CTV publishers who realized that fixing genre was an absolutely top priority for them.
There's even small things like we use rom-com as an example. Some people will put like rom-com, some put rom-com, some put romantic comedy. If it doesn't match up exactly to what's in the DSP, it doesn't get the same level of bid. So that standardization and us being kind of in the middle of the DSPs and the publishers has been really a really strong differentiator for us in market, and specific to CTV publishers, and being able to help them, one, monetize better, but also just see higher CPMs based off of something as simple as standardizing their genre taxonomy.
I'm curious that, you know, just going back to the, you know, the policy on resellers, and, you know, you'll often see ad tech companies sort of introduce these measures. We're not doing this anymore. We're filtering out this other nonsense that's going on over here. But I'm always curious, you know, does honesty pay in this industry? You know, by that I mean, do advertisers reward it? And I say that where I always incredibly frustrated with, advertisers and advertiser groups clutching their pearls at the latest scandal by a large platform, and then, you know, sometimes they'll pause spend completely in notable examples like X. But equally then I feel like a lot of the time they make a bit of noise about it, then they're all back spending within a month or so, and then, you know, massive platforms who have, you know, repeatedly been caught ripping them off just seem to keep having, you know, huge bumper growth and more investment. So I'm just curious about, you know, does honesty pay in this industry? And
yes and no. The official stance is certainly yes. But I would say nothing that you said I would disagree with. So I would say there's a couple different areas that I would I think it's important to call out. So, you know, the ANA came out with that the report on MFA, I don't know, 2 years ago, whatever it was, right before Cannes. And I would say in general, that became one of the buzziest things to talk about is, MFA is everywhere. I would say sometimes I think the amount of press that something like that gets is actually maybe even more of the cause of kind of that clutching of pearls is as soon as an agency, as soon as a report like that comes out, the agencies are getting bombarded with emails from their clients, right? Asking, are we doing this? I need more information. When in all actuality, I think like there are good and bad players in within the agency's world with MFA long before that AA report came out. Like I use Omnicom as an example. They've been working off of a whitelist and they have anything else blocked for years now. So when that ANA report came out, I don't think Omnicom was particularly worried about that because they've been working with their SSP partners to, again, curate supply for many years prior to that ANA report coming out. So how like Omnicom would have looked within that report is wildly different than I would say some of the agencies that weren't working as closely with their SSP partners. I would say what's challenging is because there's so many players in kind of the ecosystem that what happens is like by us eliminating MFA, I think it's often a positive when you're looking at like SPO RFIs or just RFIs in general. Like you are rewarded by having less MFA and or just like more direct supply in general. But I would say when it comes down to it, it's really challenging because there's KPIs that perform better when you have MFA included, like viewability or those types of like media vanity metrics that if OpenX was the only SSP to eliminate MFA and the DSP algorithms are optimizing to vanity metrics because that's what the buyers ultimately are trying to drive, that we're not then rewarded for that. It actually can hurt us by eliminating MFA. We did it anyway, and you know, we did take a little bit of a dip for a bit there. But I think that then the ecosystem kind of caught up with that, and then we did start to be rewarded for it. I think we've been massively rewarded by what we've done with TV by OpenX. We've seen the revenue come in, we've seen buyer adoption happen, and we've even been told that this is a massive initiative that people are excited about. So I think it kind of depends on how much press, negative press something is getting, and ultimately how much the agencies have to respond to that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, industry KPIs are an absolute car crash from what I hear. Yes. Where you know, I mean, are there any that are fit for purpose, do you think? Or it just feels like we constantly keep creating these KPIs that are gamed or somebody can find a way of gaming and everyone looks good in the spreadsheet. Often,
yeah,
you know, the clients or the procurement teams are complicit in, great, the bullshit KPI makes me and my colleagues look great, the CFO is going to love us, bonuses all around. So yeah, I'm curious, you know, what KPIs that actually align with effectiveness for an advertiser look like, and we would hope that they would also reward premium quality publishers who are actually delivering meaningful results for an advertiser. I mean, is there any way of disentangling this mess, or any KPIs that you think hold true value?
Yeah, I've always been a huge fan of incrementality, and I don't mean like incremental reach. I mean incrementality in the form of like actually testing it against like there's a couple different ways of looking at incrementality. There's your standard like PSA, where you're serving a percentage of your impressions to a PSA and seeing if the partner tactic, whatever, is actually driving incremental performance for you. Again, at that point, you have to have some sort of a performance KPI that goes beyond a vanity metric to track that. But I think incrementality is one that I've always found interesting. And there's a lot of work that has been done with DSPs with ghost bidding. There are partners out there that are doing like viewability holdout groups to test incrementality. MIQ utilized that when I was there. But I've always been a huge fan of incrementality. It really does show like, did your... By putting this partner or supply source or whatever on a plan, did it actually drive anything that you wouldn't have seen performance for by serving a PSA ad? And I think that's always some of the most interesting things that I've looked at is something that looks really strong from a CPA standpoint might actually be one of your worst performers if you're looking at it from a incremental CPA. So I've always been a big believer in incrementality testing.
I know there's some dispute over the different methodologies, but it's never ceased to amaze me that it took us so long to get around to measuring attention and people paying attention to an ad. It's like, ah, we've got this new thing. Are people paying attention to the ads?
Like viewability 2.0, basically.
I'm not going to get into which is better and all the rest of it. But I know people who've really gone into the weeds on it. And I know there was, some people saying, oh, we found attention measurement doesn't work, which I just think is absolute nonsense. when, you know, how can people not be paying attention? Obviously, there's other things at play as well. But
I mean, you can kind of debate methodologies, but I think the goal or aspiration to be measuring attention is a worthwhile venture.
So if we were to give one piece of advice or, you know, a pearl of wisdom to somebody coming up in the ranks who, you know, aspires to be the next CRO of OpenX, what would it be?
Yeah, I think there's two things. I think, I guess one of the things I look for when hiring or partnering or whatever is intellectual curiosity. I think you live in your world. You know, when I was at Samba TV for a handful of years, if I wasn't researching things that fell outside of ACR tech, I wouldn't have known about, you know, the evolution of in-housing or just the other areas that interest me. So I think no matter what you're doing, have a level of intellectual curiosity to understand more about the industry or more about a segment of the industry. I think it's only going to make you better, right? And I think that it's interesting. That's one of the things that I've seen that, you know, I always, when I'm interviewing or when I'm talking to people, I ask those questions like, you know, what's an area outside of your focus that you're interested in? I personally always carve out the first hour of my day to read as much as I can about the industry, whether it be, or listen to podcasts, something like that, just to make myself more informed about the industry. And I think for me, that's made me much better, especially going to the supply side where like I understand measurement well. You know, I understand in-housing from working in it. But there's different areas within the industry that like I don't have direct experience in, but I've spent a lot of time trying to gain as much understanding as I can because the industry is interesting to me and I don't want to have to wait to learn about something until I go to a particular company. And the second is don't burn bridges. This is a small industry. And I think, you know, when I was on the agency side, it was always really important to me to treat the tech vendors and partners well. And I think that that served me well as too, because I didn't have a reputation of being a difficult client, which then, you know, you have a lot of people vouching for you when you're looking for your next role. And so it's something I say to people that are, you know, starting out into the industry is just don't burn bridges. It's the industry is way too small and people don't seem to forget when you treat them poorly.
And time goes by so quickly. And before you know it, you're, you know, in your 40s, which is often, you know, thought of as old in this industry, you know, in terms of when you're looking for your next job, you know, unless you're extremely established in a senior role, it can often be quite challenging for people to get that new gig at that level. Yeah. And it's just, I've seen it before where, you know, people who, you know, treated everyone well, made it, it was that little bit easier for them where there's another type of person who maybe bullied their way up and thought nobody noticed. And everyone takes a little bit of schadenfreude in seeing them, you know, once they're knocked off their perch and looking for help, people are just obviously going to be, you know, remember that, you know, bully boy or bully woman, the bully boy tactics, which I, in all honesty, I feel like certainly in the UK, I've noticed a massive shift in agency culture, particularly where the agency culture seems to be far more civil and nice than it used to be, where you used to meet agency characters who were responsible for trading and you kind of feel like you were dealing with a secondary school bully. bully sometimes.
Yeah.
And
And I'll say I've experienced it and I don't forget who those people are.
Nobody does.
So, and those are often, and I can, you know, over a pint sometime give stories that that those are often the same people who reach out to you about roles at some point, or you get asked about from, you know, another agency, like, what do you think of this person? Because you're connected. It's just not worth being mean to people. I think I've seen a massive shift in agency culture as well. You don't see as much of that, but it's something that happened for a while. And I also think treating the people that work for you with kindness is important as well, because, you know, there are people when I was on the agency side who are like associates that now are running agencies. You just never know who is going to climb that ladder quickly. And again, it's just like those people are going to remember if you treated them kindly, and they're probably going to remember even more if you didn't.
I mean, and what you were saying about people having intellectual curiosity, it just reminded me of a conversation I had in a bar in London where it was the weekend. I was there to meet a friend. And there was a guy at the bar who was talking about working at an agency, and he was talking to his friend. I was listening in covertly, and
as you do over a pint at bars,
as is my way. But he was saying, "Oh, you know, I run these campaigns. We measure it. I don't have a clue if it works. It just feels so, you know, pointless. And you know, I'm looking at teaching, and you know." In fairness to him, maybe he was just in the wrong job and should have been off teaching. But I said, "Oh, you're working for an agency. What are you working for?" We got chatting, and I said, "Do you not find like the context that you're in, you know, just so exciting? Like this industry is going so much change." He was completely oblivious to. I remember he used the word programmatic. He said, "Oh yeah, I've heard of that," but it was you know. And in fairness, this was a time when not everyone at an agency would have been using programmatic. But still, just the lack of. I think had he understood the wider context that he was in, he would have probably realized, "Oh, I'm actually part of this," you know. He understood the competitive landscape, the technological changes. It just makes the whole thing seem so much more exciting if you understand it and appreciate it.
I completely agree. I think it's, yeah, that connection point to the industry is really important, because, you know, it can, when you're, you know, hands on keyboard trading and you're not the one that's talking to the client and understanding the value it's driving for their business and things, it can feel a little, what's the point? And I think that it is hard if you don't, you know, constantly understand the value you're driving, or at least regularly understand the value you're driving, which I think is an area that we all could get better at as we're, you know, growing within our own companies, is being able to like truly show transparently, the impact that people are having on the business. And as something at OpenX, we take really seriously. We do every quarter, we go through, a full financial statement and get everyone to understand exactly the value that their individual work has done to drive success for OpenX. And I've noticed just massive amounts of higher engagement within the organization once the overall organization knows the value that they're driving to make OpenX and us all more successful.
So final question. We give out 10 million to everyone who comes on the podcast. So I'm curious, where would you invest it and why? And it cannot be OpenX, unfortunately, as much as I'm sure.
Yeah, and I'm sure this isn't the question, but I've kind of been involved in real estate for a number of years, so I'm sure I would put a percentage of it into real estate. But I would actually say, and I don't know how popular the answer this would be, but digital out of home. I think that there's... always going to be a massive need for digital out of home. And I think it's feels like the next wave. I hear a lot about it from buyers talking about, and even when we're getting RFIs, historically digital out of home didn't come up all that often as something that was important to buyers and important specifically for the SSPs to have the proper amount of supply and capabilities within. And I feel like a digital out of home is due for kind of that big wave. So, for me, I would say I would be looking at companies that are sophisticated within digital out of home.
I completely agree with you, and I did see a chart recently that showed digital out of home that was one of the sectors that was soaring outside of the digital native stuff. The more conventional online media, and it's time has come. I would say the only thing holding back is as I find that sector is terrible at marketing itself.
Yes.
Partly, I think partly because it's been such a I don't know if you call it sort of oligopoly, I suppose, for a long time in many markets where the prime spots are owned by a handful of companies. But there just doesn't seem to be a, they seem to be terrible at generating buzz about what I, for me is it's so impactful. I've, you know, I feel like I've had my brand, my perception of a brand change so many times through a really big, impressive digital out-of-home activation in London. And I feel like, yeah, they just need to get out of their little digital out-of-home bubble, I think, and realize that they're.
Yeah, there's so much creativity in it too, which I think like a lot of times, and I'll say I'm a culprit of this as well. When I think digital out of home, I think of like, a small ad in an elevator or like on the TV at the gym, like on a treadmill or something, forgetting that there's this like huge creative industry that's around. Like some of the coolest ads I've ever seen have been digital out of home ads. And I think it's an interesting place, and I think there's more buzz around it than ever. I'm pretty sure I saw the same infographic that you did, and maybe that's partially why the growth is partially why I'm bullish on digital out of home, and that's likely where I would invest a good chunk of my money.
No, it's a good answer, and I'm
Or sorry,
envious of people.
your money, your $10 million.
No, it's you. No, we give it to the guest.
All right.
Yeah, we need to put some like legal disclaimer on that perhaps. Yeah, I'm curious about your real estate investments. Any real estate tips for the rest of us?
Yeah, so my family has been kind of in real estate for a long time, so it's been I would just say it's like an interest of mine. But my wife and I have gone through, and we've so we live in Chicago. There's a lot of lake communities around within Michigan and Wisconsin, so we've invested in kind of the lake house model with some Airbnbs, but probably more prevalently sitting on it a little bit and making money down the line of like selling the property later. And then we've also had some properties within Chicago that we rented out in like long-term real estate. I think the biggest advice I have is like you're not going to make money off of one or two properties. Inevitably, one of those properties is going to have its HVAC go out, and it doesn't matter how much you're making on the rent. That kills your profits. And so you just need to have a diverse enough portfolio, like in any sort of investment, that you're not going to be relying on one property or one situation to make your money.
Very, yeah, very sound advice. And you don't know it, but you're speaking to the world's most dysfunctional property investor, where I just keep thinking it's the top of the market, can't go any higher, and then it keeps going higher. So yeah, I've absolutely no, I keep reading very pessimistic headlines about the London property market, then not really believing them, and then things just yeah keep going up.
Well, I'll say if I lived in a city like London or New York or LA, even, I don't know if I would be investing in real estate as much as I am, with the ability to what you can spend to invest in real estate in like the Chicago and like Chicagoland area. So London feels like high risk to me.
Yeah, it's very hard to judge, and the pandemic threw a spanner in the works and changed the world, but kind of didn't. The whole thing's yeah, it's slightly perplexing. Thank you so much for taking the time. Yeah, really enjoyed that.
Yeah, this was great.
I'm going to sort of listen again to your property tips and
We can get into it. We'll go to that pub, try to listen in on some agency conversations and share some real estate tips.
that'll have to be done. Consider that a deal for next time you're in London. All right, cheers. Take care.
Amazing. Thanks. Talk soon.